Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
She was screaming at the top of her lungs, I want to kill myself, and he was holding back the knife. I rang her doctor that we totally respect, who's been her doctor since she was 15 and had anorexia. I said, what should we do, Dr. Deb? And I said, can you hear her screaming? What am I going to do, Deb? And she said, you'll just have to call the police. And I said, I don't want to call the police. They shoot mentally ill people.
Mary Kay Pershall is an American-born Australian children's author. Among her books is the Ruby Claire series, about a young girl's struggle to cope with normal life while dealing with ghosts only she can see. Mary has two daughters, both of whom she's co-written books with. One of those daughters, Katie Hornshaw, is nurturing a writing career of her own. Mary's other daughter, Anna, was the perpetrator behind one of the most salacious Australian headlines in recent memory. Woman murders man for cigarettes. We always say on this show that we want to go beyond the headlines to look at how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next. But never before has it felt more important than it does with this story. How did a beautiful little girl with a loving family grow up to commit a brutal, senseless murder? Well, the short answer in this case is mental illness. But her family's fight to stop Anna from hurting herself or anyone else is a truly terrifying insight into Australia's mental health system.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
In part one of this special two-part episode of Australian True Crime, Mary and Katie tell us the story of their family, which has always revolved around Anna in one way or another. But it was very important to Mum Mary that the conversation begin with a tribute to her daughter's victim, Zvonimir Petrovsky, also known as Johnny.
I would like to honour Mr. Petrovsky, who was the man who Anna killed. We knew him as Johnny. I met him on lots of different occasions. He actually was renting the house that Anna lived in, so he was a housemate, basically. He was very much a gentleman to me. He was born in Macedonia, very smart man.
He was a very kind and warm, and he was very kind and warm and generous. Johnny was somebody that came along at the end of Anna's decline. You know, she'd been declining for a long time, but at this stage she was using ice. She was psychotic a lot of the time. She basically just was not there. And he was one of the few people that she encountered in that time of her life that was genuinely nice to her and protective towards her, because she had a lot of men that would, you know, prey off her and treat her in horrible ways. And she was just totally at the mercy of any man that she encountered. And so that some pretty disgusting things went down. And she lived in a house with older men, because this was the only place that would take her in. And some of the men in that house were also behaving in that type of way. And Johnny was this sort of father figure. He was an aging alcoholic, so he was no sort of, he too was caught up in that world. But he tried really hard to protect Anna.
He spoke five languages. You know, he was so smart and generous and kind and funny. And he was, you know, I really liked him. And I would just like to extend our condolences to his family. We're just so sorry.
Yeah. I think it's really important to hear that backstory behind people, because often you'll see someone with, you know, alcoholism, drug addiction, and you don't know there's so much behind that. We just label people so easily, don't we?
And in both of these cases, in both Johnny and Anna's case.
Like, if you had have seen Johnny, and me too, if I had have seen him on the street, I would have written him off as probably, you know, a crazy person. He slurred his speech.
But he had a heavy accent too, so that was part of it.
But, you know, to us it seemed, you know, initially like he was fairly incoherent and fairly crazy. And that's probably what I would have written him off as if we hadn't had time to get to know him. So absolutely, our condolences, as always, to his family.
And he trusted Anna so much. And he, so many times he said to me, "She's such a good girl. I call her Dottie," meaning like daughter, you know. And so it's terrible that anyone had to die like that.
Well, and I mean, when it comes to sort of oversimplifying the situation and the people involved, the headline, "Melbourne Woman Murders Man for Cigarettes," is the way that most of the world came to learn about this story.
Exactly. And that turns Johnny and Anna into cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
And which is one reason we want to speak about it. You know, they were people, both of them. You know, Anna's a beautiful girl in many ways. And do you want to say about...
Well, Katie, you wrote such a great article on news.com.au. Not only are you Anna's big sister, but you're a beautiful writer.
Thank you.
And just talk us through some of the... I mean, the way you describe your sister is so... It makes her a very, very clear and present person for us.
Well, I think Mum and I are writers, so we were always going to write about it, and I'll continue to write about it. But the motivation for this particular article was, as I mentioned at the beginning of the article, was reading those headlines. And basically all of the headlines after Anna's sentencing hearing were some variation of that same, you know, "Melbourne woman murders man for cigarettes." And as Mum was saying, it just reduced Anna to a caricature and to a murderer. And I just had this moment where I realised that if that was not my sister and I didn't know that person and I was reading the headline, that's how I would have processed it. And that's how I do process it when I read about murderers. And I just had this sort of, you know, inception moment when I realised that every single one of these people are, you know, I'm sure are beautiful people with families and with lives, and it brought that to life so acutely for me. So
you talk about how the family sort of learned to engage with Anna, because even as a little girl, you say that she sort of struggled socially and she found life confusing.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about how Anna was as a child?
Yeah. Well, she was an adorable little baby, absolutely gorgeous. And she was normal, you know, she met all her milestones early. In fact, as a toddler, she was she enchanted adults as a toddler and preschooler. She was this gorgeous looking little thing with white blonde hair and big blue eyes. And she would prattle on about anything that was in her head at great rates for a long time. And adults love that. For example, she was really good at finding little bugs and creatures in the grass, and she would pick one up and she'd go up to an adult and show it to them and make up a huge long story about it, and people just loved it. But as soon as she got to kinder, she would do the same thing with kids, and it was just amazing. Like, she didn't look any different from any other kid, but she was labeled as a weirdo and a loser in kindergarten.
So sad that from that young, we have these labels on kids.
Yeah. Yep.
She was obviously highly intelligent from the
sounds
of it.
Oh, yeah, very intelligent, but there was something, looking back, something different about her brain.
Mm.
And she just could not fit into childhood society. And it wouldn't have, you know, there were never any birthday party invitations for her.
Oh,
no girly sleepovers.
That's really
play dates. And it wouldn't have been so bad if she didn't care, but her heart was just broken over and over again. And it was so hard for us to see that at home we tried to make her happy all the time. You know, we just tried to make up for these things. And now we wonder, by giving her that instant gratification, were we already setting her up for addiction when she was a child? Because we'd do things like I remember one night she had trouble sleeping from ever since I can remember, you know, and she would be crying in the night, you know, no one likes me. And we did try to give her practical solutions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we tried and tried, try this, try that. And we took her to a course for anxious children, but nothing seemed to work. So we just wanted to make her happy. So I'd be like, "Well, how about I make you some brownies, like at midnight?" And she'd go, "Yeah, that would make me happy." So,
yeah.
You know, I'd be doing that, and pets was a big deal. I'd be like, "Oh, you know, I just wanted her to smile and look happy." So
it was a real cycle of of Anna, you know, displaying this unhappiness, and then Mum and Dad buying her things or doing things for her, and that,
which I
that,
can understand. Yeah. Oh my god,
absolutely! Like,
yes,
you know, we were all the same, and we all did it for Anna, and because you're desperate. Mm. I mean, when someone you love is hurting like that, and even as just a little kid, she was just in so much pain, and you know, she'd just be crying and crying, and you just wanted to fix it. And if that was the only thing that would work, you know, buying her another pet or, you know, indulging her in ways that, you know, you're not supposed to, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm. So many times teachers, various authority figures would say, you've got to let her, you know, learn to live her own life. You know, stop picking things up after her and organizing things for her. But if we didn't, she'd just lose everything. And her life was a mess. So, you know, what could we do? I mean, I'm an educator, a teacher, and I couldn't figure out how to fix her, you know. So we just tried to make her happy. And she also, I mean, looking back, these are not things that occurred to us at the time, but looking back, you know, I think, you know, I'm in the 2 a.m. club where you wake up at night and think, you know, what could I have done differently? Mm. How did this happen? Mm. And she actually, I wonder now if she heard voices even when she was a kid, because she was terrified of ghosts. She heard ghosts speaking to her. She heard them breathing in her ear. And, you know, I just would sit with her until she went to sleep to try and help her through that. But now I wonder, was that an early manifestation of hearing voices?
And again, I don't think most of us would think that at the time. My kids are 7 and they say things like that, and I just kind of brush it off. You'll be right, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Come and sleep with me, whatever. It would never occur to me to
That's
think.
That's what I do. My 7-year-old has some, you know, fears that I think, oh, don't worry about that.
Yeah, totally.
That's like, but I think, well, actually I need to valid, you know, make her feel like they're important and I'm there for her.
But it would never occur to me that I was...
No.
Yeah, but years later when she feels like there's a demon inside her, which she often said in her 20s, you know, there's this demon. She would say, it's attached to me or I can't get rid of it. And as Katie said in the article, actually, ask our priest from the Anglican Church to come over, and he came over in his full robes and the holy water to try and get the demon out of her room. But, you know, that's when you look back and think, was that already there when she was a little kid and she was so afraid of ghosts?
Wow. Because she really was terrified. It wasn't sort of, oh, I think there's a ghost, you know. Even as a child, we would do rituals to help her. So, you know, Mum brought over her friend who was somebody who could talk to ghosts when Anna was a child, to speak to this little boy in the backyard that Anna was seeing. And Anna really was terrified. She wasn't able to sleep, and this is what, an 8-year-old child, and she would just lie awake at night, and so quite a few times, even as a child, we would have to figure out ways to kind of deal with these ghosts that Anna was. So it wasn't on a sort of normal level, was it? It was really, I mean, I remember thinking that at the time, that she was really struggling with these ghosts.
Well, I'm not a patient person, but I just got, you know, I just sat with her until she went to sleep. She was scared to go to sleep. She was frightened of that. So I would just sit sometimes for hours until she, because she was afraid to be in the room by herself. Even with Katie on the top bunk, you know.
Yeah.
She was afraid to go to sleep. And it got really bad when Katie moved out to her own room when Katie was in her early teens.
And how are you coping with this, Katie? You're the big sister and your little sister is a really troubled little girl for all of these reasons.
I think what it did was it created a family dynamic where I became, you know, a de facto third parent.
Mm-hmm.
And that dynamic has just continued in perpetuity. Like, it basically just meant I had to grow up fast, I think. There was an expectation on me that I would be, you know, one of the people that would be helping, and because there was very much a feeling of everyone on the outside is treating Anna horribly and giving her a hard time, and that's making her really angry and sad. And so there's only 3 of us, you know, and we all have to really pitch in and we all have to do everything we can to make her as happy as we can at home. Because
we could get backup from friends, from my friends.
From our close circle, yeah. But, yeah, there was a feeling of, ever since Anna's been a child, there's been a feeling of, like, if we don't support her, and if we don't give her what she needs, what's she going to do? You know, even when she was really, there was always that sense of like this kind of looming, you know, something.
Catastrophe.
I mean, I remember praying every single
impending
night.
Impending doom kind of thing.
When I'd go to sleep, I'd pray every single night, like it was like a ritual. I would always do it. I couldn't go to sleep without doing this. I would say, God, can you please, can you please make Anna be happy? And if you could do that, then you can, you know, I'd give him like all a list of like what he could take away from me. You can take all my friends, and you can take away, you know, all. I would come up with all the things that were important to me. And I'd say, you can take all of that, but if you could please just find a way for Anna to be happy. So it was very much a focus of our family.
Are you resentful about that? Like, I know you said you're very honest with your parents. Did that cause resentment for you?
Definitely, and yeah. Like, we've been through, you know, I'm 31 now, and we've been through times when, I guess when I was sort of in my mid-20s, I definitely went through a stage when I was trying to, I guess just get Mum and Dad to see what this had sort of done to me. And that basically it was a stage of just saying to Mum, like, I need you to be my mum and not be my sort of co-parent and my collaborator, which is always what I've been for Mum. And I guess I did go through a difficult time, and that was, you know, when I was experimenting with drugs and everything. I never, you know, fell into addiction or anything like that. But that was when, you know, I had my anorexia, and then I went into my anxiety disorder, which was really, really, that was huge for me.
Well, when you're living with a sense of impending doom about your baby sister, I can't imagine how you couldn't develop an anxiety disorder.
Yeah. Yeah,
you're hypervigilant, right?
Because, and it's the responsibility as well. It's that feeling like when something bad happens to her that it's partially my fault. And
yeah, and it became even more extreme because she very nearly died when she was 15 of anorexia.
Anna did.
Yeah.
Wow.
She came really close. The hospital said it was one of the most compromised cases they'd ever seen. Because she'd always been skinny, we didn't realize that anorexia was happening. Mm-hmm. We thought that happened to people. Well, I thought that happened to girls who were a bit chubby. They decided to lose weight. But she was always skinny. But she just started eliminating more and more foods until she was practically eating nothing. And she was quite tall for her age, and she got down to 37 kilos. And, yeah, she was admitted to hospital. And she they put her on a heart monitor at night because they were afraid that her heart was going to stop when she was sleeping.
So at that point, did they realise she had serious mental illness? When was that diagnosed?
Was 15.
Yeah.
Just turned 15. Well, she did get psychological help. She was an outpatient at the Children's Hospital until she was 18, and we feel she got excellent care from the public health system.
Was she diagnosed with anything in particular? Apart from the anorexia, was there any, is it schizophrenia, or was there?
Her current diagnosis, but she didn't have it.
No, she wasn't properly. We still feel that she hasn't been properly diagnosed. Okay. She has been diagnosed over time with bipolar, with schizophrenia, with borderline personality disorder, which at the moment we feel like fits her personality the best. But that's only been in recent type as well. Well, there was a psychiatrist that said he thought she had schizophrenia.
I've read that some quite tricky to treat, borderline personality disorder.
Yeah. But the diagnoses came much later. There was, because when she was a teenager, we still had a feeling that we didn't want to kind of put a label on her, because we thought that might actually make her, you know, feel worse and feel. Because at the time, what we thought she probably had was Asperger's. And we still think that she's on the spectrum.
Okay.
And she's never been properly diagnosed with that either. But the reason that we avoided wanting to put that label on her is because the way she was, we just thought that might just crush her, and we thought
she'd grow out of it. We always thought she'd get better year by year. She would progress. Maybe she was slower at growing up than some people, but that she would grow out of it. But after the anorexia scare, the like trying to keep Anna alive became set more of a focus.
Because
once she got home, we just, if she would just eat, you know, that's all we wanted.
So we've gone from trying to keep Anna happy to trying to keep her alive.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So she controlled really the whole household.
She did.
Yeah, from that point on, a dynamic was set up in our house, which just became more and more intense over the years, where essentially Anna was the one in control. And it was always, at the beginning, it was implicit that the threat was she would die. And then eventually it became explicit that I will kill myself if you don't do this, this and this. And Mum became more and more and more just Anna's sort of servant. And Dad and I were just sort of proxies. Nobody challenged Anna. Dad is an extremely forthright, commanding person, and the only person that I've ever seen have any power over him whatsoever is Anna. And that just became more intense as the years went on, that dynamic.
How long did you think that could go on, Mary? I mean, what were you thinking in that period of time?
Well, I actually had a bit of an epiphany in the middle of 2014, which was the last year that Anna lived with us. I just got to the point where, I mean, up until the last few months that she lived with us, there were always times when she could be funny. You know, she can be very funny and witty and intelligent. Mm. She can be charming. So there always were times when I, you know, still connected with her a lot. And we spent a lot of time together. You know, we wrote three books together, which were, you know, quite successful, especially the first one, two weeks in grade six. So, we spent a lot of time together. And even during those last months, up until the very few last months, she could still be fun to be with.
I suppose you probably have to do that in order to keep control. You probably have to give and take, don't you? You have to be charming sometimes.
Yeah.
You have to keep the love fire burning so that you can get away with the demanding bad behaviour, I guess.
To get what you want.
Yeah. At the end, when she was towards the end of her time with us, I mean, she didn't do drugs until after she finished university. She got a degree in psychology from Swinburne University.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. She has a degree in psychology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was, while she was at uni, she was living with this wonderful boy that she met, and he just loved her dearly. He, you know, all guys loved her for her looks. You know, she was attractive. She had this beautiful body. You know, as I said, you know, the blonde hair and the big blue eyes. She always looked 10 years younger. So she looked like she was a teenager, didn't she?
She still looks like she's a teenager.
Even people that know us and had seen her grow up would forget. They'd think when she was in her mid-20s, they thought of her as 16, didn't they? Yeah, that was a constant thing, you know.
So around her late teens and early 20s, she went to university, got a degree and had a successful relationship.
Yep, so she went through a period where...
She had some good years.
Wow!
When we say that she was making gradual improvements, it was like when she had a difficult childhood, but she, as we were saying, she was making gradual improvements, a lot slower than most people. But there was a time when every year would be better than the year before, and this kind of culminated in her getting together with this person, this man Andrew. that... But she always needed looking after. So she moved from Mum and Dad's place to Andrew's place.
Okay.
And
his mum. She lived with him and his mum.
Okay.
And he looked after her. But, you know.
So he was able to sort of support her through
the
degree. Like she put everything she had into the degree, and everything else in her life was arranged by Andrew
she
and
didn't
by his
do-
mum.
Any like part-time work or
but down to the finer details, like like she still wasn't, she was never capable of sort of organizing the miniature, is that how you say that word,
minutia.
I'm saying it like I read it, of life. Like that's always needed to be taken care of for her, you know, just appointments, tickets for public transport, bills. She's never managed that type of thing. So she was able to put all of her...
Couldn't learn to drive.
No. So only focus on one thing and do that amazingly.
Exactly.
And everything else kind of...
Yeah. But at that time she had the capability to do that, to focus on one thing and do well at that. And then it was after she left Andrew that the decline started. So she stopped making improvements and started making declines.
Well, that was I think that was the most heartbreaking time for me, was at the end of that relationship, because it just had so much potential and so much potential for her.
And it must have felt like she was potentially becoming quote-unquote normal.
Yeah, it did.
Like growing out of it, as you said, as a child.
Yeah, we were always hoping. That was always the hope. And when she was with Andrew, we thought, we assumed that she would continue to make improvements. And that's because she was still only in her early 20s at this stage, so we always thought she was going to grow out of it.
Mm.
That's what we were. Now it seems stupid that we convinced ourselves of that. But like looking back, but I remember that was the narrative. That's what we'd talk about, is she's going to get
And we were
better.
So happy.
You know? Well, you must have been desperate. I mean, everyone needs hope in their lives. Yeah. And you guys in particular had been through such a long, hard road with girl.
And I was so happy for her. I thought, thank God, finally something good has happened to her.
And therefore, for all of you.
And, you know, he bought them a house.
Wow.
When they moved into that house, and she was expected to be an adult after she finished her degree, she just couldn't, and that was just so hard to see.
What happened in the end? What was the break of that relationship?
Oh, she just couldn't. Well, Andrew, everyone, we all expected her to have a career. Mm. We thought you either do some postgraduate study or you get a job. She just now I can just see that she retreated into all sorts of addictions. It wasn't just alcoholism and weed, which she started doing heavily during that time after she moved into the house
when Andrew bought them a house and they moved into the house with just the two of them, that's actually when she started to drink heavily and use weed, because up until that point Andrew's mother had been looking after basically the two of them.
Yeah.
And then Andrew expected when they would move out that Anna would take over the domestic duties, and she couldn't do that.
And get a job. Yeah. And she didn't do either.
So self-medicating started to cope with that situation, do you
think? Being alone all day in the house, feeling guilty that, you know, she wasn't able to do what she was supposed to be doing. You know, she was supposed to be keeping the house clean and cooking dinner and whatever. And Andrew even said, as long as you do that, you know, you don't need to work, you know, at least for a while. But I think she felt bad that she couldn't kind of summon whatever was needed to keep the house in order.
So she just turned herself off somehow, either through alcohol, drugs, watching DVDs, sleeping, playing with her pet. She got herself a bunch of guinea pigs. Mm. Again, you know, sort of escaping into and PlayStation. That was another one of her addictions. She would do that endlessly.
Mm.
So, and watch cat videos. So just anything to...
You can climb into all of those things, can't you?
And just avoid
the world.
And it is very overwhelming, I think, for some people, the nature of trying to do that kind of stuff. Like
adulting.
Day-to-day. Yeah,
adulting. There are websites and Tumblr sites and blogs all about how hard adulting is.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah. It's not – adulting's not simple.
No.
You know, and a lot of people do struggle with it. So, you know, if relatively normal people struggle with it, you know, imagine how Anna –
And it causes a lot of friction in relationships at the best of times. No doubt her partner had a lot of resentment maybe or anger or
But he still loved her.
Yeah.
I suppose he had the frustration that you guys were very familiar with.
Yeah, he was in a similar position to us. He had, you know, been her champion and was trying to...
He was so proud of her when she got a degree.
Yeah.
Sounds like so a lovely, lovely man.
Yeah, he's gorgeous, and we're really thankful for the role he played in her life. But eventually she just wasn't able to keep that together. And so when she moved back to Mum and Dad's, the way I discovered that she was drinking heavily was actually a huge shock, because she hadn't drank really up until that point. She hadn't used drugs. She was, as Mum said, she had her escapisms that she would indulge in all day, but up to that point, none of them had been alcohol or drugs. But I remember going over to see her at Andrew's place at one of the, you know, last times that she was actually there before she left. And getting there at 10 a.m. and, you know, I had coffee and donuts with me and stuff. And this was one of her ideas about how she was, because she was always trying to get famous. She always thought that the way that she was going to be successful was she would become rich and famous instantly. So this idea was she wanted to be a YouTube star, and
well, she's not the only one. Yeah. Not uncommon.
Yeah. So, and I was supposed to be the one that would facilitate this. Like, I was asked to facilitate, you know, her rap career and her YouTube career. So at this point it was YouTube. So I was coming over and we were going to make YouTube videos. And I remember walking in the door and I could just smell the alcohol just coming off her, and she had obviously been drinking really heavily. And I realised that that was a pattern that she'd fallen into, and I hadn't even noticed, you know. And so from that time, she moved back to mum and dad's soon after, and that was when the real decline started. That's when
this is what you refer to as the decline.
Yeah, and that's where the sort of article picks up, is talking about that.
Well, I couldn't believe how she was when she came back, because she hadn't lived with us for a few years by then. And I couldn't. She'd get up in the morning and I expected her to look for a job. She actually would make lists of what she was going to do. Like, she'd make these complicated schedules. At 9 a.m. I'm going to get up, do this, blah, blah, blah. What she would actually do was get up and head straight up, as Katie said in her article, to the backyard with a bong and do that all day. And I think someone with that's already got a, you know, that might be mentally, have a mental illness, the drugs just push them over. Yeah. And I think what really cracked her brain was synthetic weed.
Yes.
She discovered that, you know, she was very passive. She didn't know how to, like, go out and find a person who had real weed. But she found out that at the sex shop you could buy synthetic weed. And you don't know what's in that stuff.
Yeah, I've heard that's a shocking, shocking, and it really speeds up mental decline.
And we don't know what's in it. I mean, it's called synthetic weed, but it's just herbs sprayed with chemicals from China, wherever it
comes
from.
That's the thing. It's not actually a plant. It's disgusting chemicals sprayed onto leaves.
Available for anyone.
Yeah. And now there's more and more stuff coming out about how it does, it can bring on psychosis. And for Anna, that was, her behavior changed really rapidly when
she smoked
started
a lot of
that
stuff. And it was expensive. And she would, like, hold it over. She would promise me that she'd be good. Or, you know, we were trying to get her into various rehabs and detoxes, and she'd say, well, I'll do that if you go and buy me some synthetics. Mm. So, you know, I became a regular customer at the sex shop buying these things called, you know, Celestial Beauty or, well, all these different names they had.
Yeah.
Making my way past the vibrating panties to get to the counter where I could buy the weed.
You're not the first parent I've ever. You're the first parent I've heard of who's had to go to the sex shop for it. But I've certainly met parents who've been scoring heroin for their kids for these. I mean, because it's so gradual, isn't it? I mean, this is just from 23 years or something by this stage of you trying to help your baby daughter and help her be happy and help her cope that you end up in this situation, which is crazy.
Mm. Yeah,
and this is she. At this stage, she was perfecting the art of manipulating mum.
I mean, that's why I did it, not because I wanted her to do drugs, but because she would say, I'll do this if you do that, and I would do it.
And did you think she might be safer doing it kind of?
It was a thing of let's keep her at home.
Yeah,
definitely.
Let's keep it, control it.
What did you think would happen, or did you ever say, no, Anna, I'm not going to buy it? What was the punishment for you if you didn't go and buy it for her?
She'd kill herself.
Right.
Mm. Okay. Which is the worst thing that you can say to a mother.
Yeah.
And as a mother, I can't imagine, if you know what I mean. Like, you just would do anything to make your child happy and safe, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And it was so frightening. Like, it just got the threat of her killing herself became more and more of a realistic possibility as time went on.
We thought it would happen. We thought it was inevitable. We definitely thought she was going to die. All of us did. That's why it was so, I mean, Katie and I used to talk about it that, you know, when she'd disappear, she would usually not answer her phone. She usually wouldn't be in a frame of mind to do that. But because she always had some guy, they would usually answer the phone. I would always make sure that I had the phone number of whatever man was in her life at the time. And he would usually answer. So this light, you know, how your brain would light up. Oh, God, she's alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is she actually with you? I'd say, yes, she's here. She's fine. And then, you know, your brain would feel great. And then gradually over maybe the next half an hour or hour, it would start to get a little bit darker, like, but is she still alive now?
Yeah. Mm. Or if she'd do a Facebook post, or if she'd...
Mm, oh, that's right.
Of course.
So, yeah, when she'd... we were always all in that mode of like if any of us would see a Facebook post or we'd get a text message or whatever, there'd be any digital evidence of Anna. We'd all call each other and go, okay, she's all right, okay, now. And so...
So meanwhile, can I just ask, Katie, what's happening in your life at this stage? What's your career? What's your work? What's your relationship status?
So this stage of... This coincided probably with the time that was quite difficult for me as well. So, it was probably around the worst part time of my anxiety disorder. So I was living in Brunswick in a share house with friends. I was doing uni. I was finishing my anthropology degree. I was working at a little restaurant. So I was keeping up with all of my life. I've always been very much a functioning, you know, mentally ill person. Mm-hmm. But I was definitely struggling with my anxiety disorder had reached the point where it was on a constant sort of loop in my head. I would sort of obsess over various things.
Well, of course. And, you were expecting your baby sister, who you felt responsible for, to kill herself any moment. I mean, of course.
Yeah. So I think obviously it was taking its toll on all of us. And so that was sort of going around on, you know, in a loop on in my mind. And I was finding it really, really difficult to focus or to enjoy anything else. It got to the point where, you know, that was just sort of taking up my entire existence. I'd be doing other things and going out and talking to people and sort of going through the motions, but I realized I wasn't enjoying seeing my friends. I wasn't enjoying doing anything because I'd just be sitting there. I'd be talking, but in my head it'd be going, what's happening with Anna? What's happening with Anna? You know, and other, you know, I'd be worried about other things in my life as well. It was just my anxiety was taking over.
We didn't necessarily think that she would suicide, but we thought she'd die somehow because of the terrible risks she put herself into.
Yeah.
I mean, from the time she was a teenager, she would, the police called us up, you know, your daughter's been caught train surfing.
Wow.
And then later, trains were kind of figured heavily in her life because that's how she would meet people. She wasn't capable of meeting people through the usual channels. So she would get on a train and she would go off with these random men. I mean, how often can you do that?
And survive
and stay
it.
Alive. Yeah.
And the vulnerability of it and the kind of people who gravitate towards that. Like, how did you cope with that? Because that, the fear of her dying, the fear of who these men were, what was happening
it was hard,
to her.
Especially when she started bringing these guys that we were actually afraid of
to your house.
Into our house.
Yeah.
And manipulating us. But after a while, because I'm a person that's fairly joyful, I think, and full of life, and I had this epiphany through a lot of, I got a lot of help with my own mental health. I got a fantastic psychologist. I went to meetings. I have a really tight-knit circle of girlfriends, but also professional help. And in the middle of 2014, I just had this epiphany, and I thought, well, I want to live. I want to live and be joyful and enjoy life, and there's nothing I can do. And this was talking to John as well. There's nothing I can do to keep her alive.
God, what a moment for a mother.
Mm. And
you can't keep your child alive.
No, you can't keep anyone alive if they're not helping you do it.
And I felt terrible, but I thought, well, I can still contribute to the next generation. So I became a tutor through the Children's Hospital, through Ronald McDonald House. So I felt that I was contributing to the next generation. I couldn't help my own daughter, but I could help these other kids who were struggling.
That's an amazing epiphany to have.
Yeah, really.
And
nice.
I meet all that.
I just want to say how we had that night when we...
Oh, that's right. The elephant in the room.
Yeah, because we had all... there was quite a long time that went past when we would not discuss with each other the possibility of Anna dying or killing herself. It's like we thought if we said
it
out loud. But there was a night when Mum and Dad and I were all together and she'd just run off again and nobody knew where she was. She'd tricked Mum into running off by asking Mum to take her to McDonald's and asking Mum to buy her two meals for whatever reason, which Mum, of course, did because she just did anything for Anna. And then Anna threw these two meals all over the table, knowing that Mum would have to clean it up. And then she ran off to the train, and so she'd just done that.
Wow, as a diversion.
Yeah. So she had her tricks.
And,
wow.
And so that was the night, because we had only just got her back from this man's house that was abusing her at the time, and it had taken so much effort to get her back, and we'd, you know, tried to convince her to go to rehab. We'd been through this whole thing with her in the lead up to that, and she'd been kind of to-ing and fro-ing about whether she would go to rehab, and then she ran off again. So it was a combination of, it was a huge, exhausting thing for us that lasted a few days of basically trying to just keep Anna alive and stop her from running away.
Sorry to interrupt, but we also called the police, and I was crying on the other end with the police saying, are we allowed, can we physically restrain her to keep her from leaving the house? Because Katie's partner is a big, strong guy. He was willing to hold her, you know, and they said, no, you can't do that. That's assault. Mm. You know, you cannot legally keep her there. We would have if we could have.
Yep, and they can't help you with Anna because she hasn't committed a crime, so...
But go on
and
about
so
that.
So that
night.
Was the night that when she'd run off, we were just all in this state of
despair.
For some reason, we all just seemed to have the thought coincidentally that she's just going to die. We can't keep her alive. This is ridiculous. This is getting so stupid. You know, all of us just using all of our resources, just desperately trying to keep her alive. And she's running back to this ice addict's house who she's got cigarette burns all over her body and bruises all over her that she's just called up 2 days before, you know, in hysterics saying, get me out of here, get me out of here, get me out of here. And she's just run back to that same person's house. So we just all just said it out loud. We can't keep her alive and she's probably going to die. And that was when we sort of had to... I think each of us accepted that this could go on forever. You know, when are we going to live our lives? So we somehow, it was like we started the grieving process then.
Definitely. I grieved a lot for her before. Well, obviously she's not dead, but yeah. There was a lot of grieving. I didn't want to, but I was planning her funeral.
We just couldn't work out a way that she would stay alive. We just couldn't work out how it would be possible because... At this time, this is, you know, as I say in my article, this is when we felt like we were being failed by the system. We felt like we were getting no support at all, despite, you know, Mum using all of her resources, all of her journalistic skills, you know, all of her education skills to try to find help for Anna. We couldn't find any appropriate help. We felt like we were just had been abandoned by the system. We just, you know, we were out of ideas.
Next week, in part two of Mary and Katie's story.
One of the things you're afraid of is that they'll die in this really horrible way.
So on the freeway, she tries to jump out of the back of the car.
On one occasion, she said to the person doing the assessment, I'm having homicidal thoughts. Yeah, so he returned and she wanted him to buy her cigarettes.
Thank you for downloading our Australian True Crime podcast. If you have an Australian true crime story of your own you'd like to share with us, let us know on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. We'd also love it if you'd give us a nice review on iTunes and 5 stars. Thank you to Sherry Laurie, Michael Davarin, Kieran Simpson and Alex Loran for their help in pulling this project together. We'll be back with more Australian true crime next week. Until then, stay safe.